Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to those who are visiting with us. We are studying Ecclesiastes, and this morning we come to the fourth chapter, which is our plan to cover today. So very good to be together and to explore this book, which is indeed very thought-provoking. So welcome. Let's start with a prayer. And Earl, could you lead our thoughts, please, as we begin?
Our Father in heaven, we thank you for opportunities such as these, convenient locations such as this to assemble, to study your word, and to be together. We pray that you'll be with us this morning as we open the Bible, the book of Ecclesiastes, as it relates to our lives under the sun, and help us, Father, to understand the balance between the life that we live here upon this earth under the sun and what we have to look forward to through Christ our Lord, which is life eternal with you, made possible through his sacrifice. And it's through his name we pray.
Amen. So, the term that we sometimes use, although it may have just diminished a little bit in usage over the last couple decades, the term rat race. What does it mean? What do you think of? The rat race. I'm not talking about a rodent sport. Okay? It's an expression.
Trying to get ahead in this world.
Way people live. Masses of people.
Might be the traffic. The cycles that you have to go through. I don't know. Most people getting to work and getting right. back and getting out. It's just like a rat race.
Right. Scurrying about. It's the idea that all these different rats are spreading around, moving about. Do rats work fast or slow? Yeah, pretty fast. But we think of rats as having a pretty, lowly existence, okay? And rats are just, trying to get what they can for themselves, that kind of thing. So it's a pretty apt expression for the scurrying about that humans do to do the things they do on a regular basis. But yet, it's just sort of a endless cycle that in the long run doesn't amount to anything. And so rat race is a good expression for some of the things that the wise preacher, the writer of Ecclesiastes, is giving us, the pictures that he's painting for us. That's a modern expression that would be very appropriate for it. And this is the book that has a very unique ring of truth to it. It doesn't matter what humans think of the Bible, whether they agree with it or not agree with it, like it or not like it. The evidence is that this is God's written word. And we're not judging it. It's judging us. And so God's truth stands as it stands. However, this book does ring true regarding human experience. We don't determine truth by human experience. But in human experience, God sometimes bakes in his truth. He's teaching us in our experiences oftentimes. And so this man is looking at life under the sun, in other words, just your strictly earthly existence. And even though God will penetrate this analysis every now and then, he's trying to get us to see the emptiness, the vanity of just living in this life for this life, which then is the salt on the tongue. It whets our appetite to see if there is something beyond this life. And of course, God is going to, penetrate this text, and thus there is God that's guiding things and God that we can be accountable for, which then puts things in a very different light. So as a result, we're seeing that the book of Ecclesiastes is echoed in our experiences, and that's why we're occasionally looking at some statements of humans that are very Ecclesiastes-like. And these are going to phase out. I'm not going to have as many of these as we've had. But I hope that this sort of stimulates your thinking so that when you read a novel or you read a poem or you hear a song, you're like, ah, yeah, that's very Ecclesiastes-like, which pulls you into the scriptures to say, look at this insight that's there. So for instance, let's go highbrow and lowbrow again, like we've been doing. So Lord Byron, early 19th century British poet, known as Lord Byron, that he had a name. He writes this about fame. He says, what is the end of fame? 'Tis but, and he's a pretty famous guy, by the way. What is the end of fame? 'Tis but to fill a certain portion of uncertain paper. Some liken it to climbing up a hill whose summit, like all hills, is lost in vapor. Okay, lowbrow. John Cougar Mellencamp. He would be glad to take that title too, just like the Stones. Paper and Fire is the song. She had a dream, and boy, it was a good one, and she chased after her dream with much desire. But when she got too close to her expectations, well, the dream burned up like paper and fire. Like paper and fire. I mean, that's what the Ecclesiastes writer has been depicting. I did this, I accomplished that, I built that, and in the end, it's like paper and fire. It's empty. So, how does this, we've gotten enough of this to get a feel for it. How does this brute truth, this depiction of the stark reality of earthly life, how does it help? I know it depresses. Good.
It pushes you toward God.
Yeah. Is there something else? Is there something better? Is there something more? Yeah. What other ways is it helping you? Or not?
Helps you not to try to put too much stock and value in this life.
Yeah. I mean, you've got a little table here. It's just a little old table. You don't put 50 brick on it. You can set a little vase on it. It can only hold so much. It's only dependable for so much. And so when it comes to the experiences of this life, even the good life, as people would depict it, prosperity and notoriety and all those kinds of things, it doesn't really hold that much. We have to adjust expectations. And to me, I just think that's what is so, one of the marvelous things, the more I've studied this book, is all these statements about how dark things are and empty they are, but enjoy life. And it's a head scratcher, but at the same time, this is how you enjoy life, is you lower your expectations. And you put the expectations really where they need to be. And that is on God and spiritual and eternal things, which the rest of the Bible answers. So this is where we're at. The first two chapters, Daryl and I were talking about this, I think, Wednesday night, how that those first two chapters are like a bomb. The book of Ecclesiastes does not phase you into the topic. I mean, within just a few lines, he drops the bomb. All is vanity. And then he goes, bang, he drops another bomb. He blows everything to smithereens in the first two chapters. And then it's like, okay, now how do you sort through this rubble? What do you got left? What do you do with it? It's just rubble. So what can you make out of it? So we're in that section where he's starting to help us navigate life. He's going to continue to make the same conclusion, all is vanity. And he's going to make a lot of observations that sort of go to deeper layers of that. We'll see that at the beginning of this chapter. But he's also going to drop things in here to help us navigate life. Chapter 4 is more observations, but as we'll see, he's going to start dropping proverbs on us so that we can steer through this vain life. So let's look at chapter 4, verses 1 to 3. Vince, can you read that for us? 1 to 3, please.
Then I looked again at all the acts of oppression which were being done under the sun. And behold, I saw the tears of the oppressed, and that they had no one to comfort them. And on the side of their oppressors was power, but they had no one to comfort them. So I congratulated the dead who are already dead more than the living who are still living. But better off than both of them is the one who has never existed, who has never seen the evil activity that is done under the sun.
All right, thank you.
There's an old adage, power corrupts. And absolute power, what? Corrupts absolutely. That's a good one to throw alongside Ecclesiastes. We saw in the last chapter a reference made about injustice. And here we have a continuation of that. He's cycling back to that idea. And he's talking about people who are oppressed. He even calls the tears of the oppressed. And they had no one to comfort them. He's not just saying, but before he talks about, I looked where righteousness should be. This is chapter 3, and I saw, you know, injustice. I saw wickedness. Here he goes further. It's more poetic, and he says, they're oppressed people, which means somebody's oppressing them. And he describes their tears, and further that, there's no one to comfort them. Okay? Do we still see this? Is this common? Oppressed people, tears, no one to comfort them. Yeah. But something jumped out at me this time. I guess I just hadn't noticed it. Look closely at verse 1. Who else has no comforter? The oppressed and the oppressor have no comforters. I mean, it's like if you really, truly believe in survival of the fittest, then it makes perfect sense to do anything to anybody, anytime you can to help yourself. Lie, cheat, steal, manipulate, con, whatever. Because if you're able to get from them and benefit yourself somehow, then all the more better for you, and you've proven yourself to be superior. Okay? But it doesn't work that way. I was driving yesterday morning, and I was listening to this talk show about, and they were interviewing this guy who was a former FBI, I think. And they were talking about how that they had set up cons to con men. Don't you love that? And so there was this group of con guys in California, and they were getting mostly older people to invest in these false schemes, like hundreds of thousands of dollars. And like this one guy had made like $4 million in 2 years doing this, just robbing people over the phone. And so they actually set up a fake person to trap him, okay? And what they said was right before they busted this guy, when they came into his office and they busted him and they raided it, he said he looked around and he saw these notes and he saw these religious tracts that he'd been doing this for years, but recently he was starting to have a moral dilemma about what he was doing. He had robbed so many people and ripped off so many people. Finally, it was starting to eat away at him. Too late, put him in jail. But isn't that interesting? You would think somebody would be heartless. You see, even if you're the oppressor, you're the guy on top, you're not going to win. You're not going to have comfort in that. Not in the long run. There's not comfort in that. Remember, it was about a decade ago, the Bernie Madoff thing, probably one of the most notorious schemes, you know, in American, you know, economic history. And he died such a pathetic figure, remember? Such a pathetic figure. So, as he's talking about this injustice, in a way, there's a little justice baked in here. Because if you're oppressed, you're needing comfort and not getting it. But if you're the oppressor, in another way, it's going to hurt you. And you're not going to have comfort. That got by me for the longest time. I don't know why. I'm sure it didn't you. But this book is, it has so many layers to it. It's so many subtleties to it. Okay? And just when you look at verse 2 and 3, just when you think, after chapters 1 and 2, just as you think this guy can't go any lower in his assessment of things, he goes lower. What? How low does he go in verse 2 and 3? Things are so bad that what? He's better to be dead than alive. And not only the one, there's even one who's better off than the dead, and that's who?
They've never been born.
And that's sad. There's one very noted place in the New Testament where that's said about somebody. It's better if he was never born. Remember? Jesus said that about Judas. That's sad as it gets, right? It really is. Yes, that comes up with Job a lot. I mean, that's why this wisdom literature or Old Testament poetry, it does have an organic kind of connection to it. Job to Psalms to Proverbs to Ecclesiastes. I mean, it really, really does. Okay? So anyway, all right. You know, we live in an age that really celebrates naturalism, that what you see is what there is. Well, this is what you get out of that. This is the final chapter. If all there is just the physical, natural world, in other words, life under the sun, then for really most people, it's better off if they were not even alive or never been born when you look at all they have to go through. Yeah.
Why so many Nazis killed themselves at the end of World War II? Because their faith was in that, and they didn't have anything else. And that was over.
Yeah. There's dozens of stories from Ecclesiastes about that. I mean, it's one of the reasons why they built the gas chambers is because the soldiers who were actually executing Jewish people by firing squads were going crazy, lining up innocent people and killing. So they had to find an industrial way to do it that was impersonal. And so, well, why was that bothering them if it's all about the superiority of, you know, you and you triumphing over someone else? You know, again, the oppressor is not comforted.
And the oppressor never has enough either. Which
never
is
ends. It is.
I mean, they get everything they need, but they still keep doing it.
It's not enough.
Something is going to finally fulfill that.
And in that, that's one of the aspects of no comfort. You have every comfort you can afford, but you still don't have comfort. So, there you go. All right. So, I hope you, you know, come every day to this class with, okay, we're ready for, you know, waiters on to go in deep, okay? Because it really makes you think about things. All right, 4-6. Ray Conies, can you read that 4-6, please?
Then I saw that all toil and all skill in work comes from a man's envy of his neighbor. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. The fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh. Better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil and a striving after wind.
Okay, it comes back to this theme of work again. You know, and we do tend to think in terms of careers and occupations with work. And that's not always the case in the Bible. It just means any kind of toil, anything you're trying to do to solve a problem or accomplish something or whatever. So there's three things talked about here, and it describes the drawbacks even when you succeed, but it also here is depicting it in such a way that he's able to insert some advice for us. That's very valuable. So verse 4 is talking about a person motivated to work by what reason? Envy of his neighbor.
Competition.
Yeah, competition. Keeping up with the Joneses and Smiths and the Johnsons and the Martinez and everyone else, okay? Some scholars think that this might be rendered that all you get from your work is your neighbor's envy. Either way, that's not much to work for. However, most English translations render this in a way that it sounds like that what's motivating this person is because they're trying to keep up with everybody else. I think one of the worst poisons you can inject into yourself, and it's into your thinking, is that when you look at other people, at what they have, what they've accomplished, even how they look or whatever, and you feel somehow inadequate about yourself, and you feel like, I need that, or I want that, those are very easy thoughts to have. But if you keep allowing those to be injected into your system, you'll be miserable. And the irony is, guess what? That neighbor across the street, you know what they're doing? Same thing. They're looking across the street at you and doing that. Or they're looking across the street at that guy and doing that, and that guy's looking at you and doing it. It's just sort of a crazy cycle. It's a good way to put it. You know what? Think about how many commercials actually feed on that. I mean, remember the whole commercials feeding on that. If you buy this car, you'll look like that guy, and you'll have fun like he's having, all that kind of stuff. But sometimes the commercials themselves will show a person who went and bought something, and they're disappointed, and the neighbor has something that's better, and they're like, oh, I should have gone and bought that with you. You know, yeah, come down here and buy it. I mean, it actually feeds on that kind of mentality. It's interesting. So here's this person who's just working to keep up with everybody else, and it's just a sad kind of existence. And then he talks about somebody else. And they're called, verse 5, what's the label? Who is it? Fool, okay? And I think it's good and well to think about the Fool of Proverbs in this because it really coincides with it. But with all this talk about how vain your toils are, what has this person done? What's the expression? What has he done? He stopped. He folded his hands, which is an expression for he stopped working. In other words, as we would say in the mountains, he's not striking a lick. He's just giving up. You sort of see that, right? So this is a very important little tidbit right here. Because if you think the right conclusion from everything this wise man is saying is just give up and fold your hands, you've missed it. Okay? And there are a lot of reasons why we've missed it. But right here, baked into this old statement, when this person just gives up and folds their hands, what does it say about him? What does this do?
He consumes his own flesh.
Yeah, he destroys himself. It eats it. It's a self-destructive kind of outcome, isn't it?
We see it. Evidence of it everywhere. Anytime you pull off the interstate.
Yeah. 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 And we don't always know the background. We understand that. I think there's a lot of mental illness there. But it is a self-destructive because there are cases where people try to help them and it doesn't do them any good. It's self-destructive. So self-destructive. Yeah. Well, we need balance here, right? Verse 6 provides it. So one guy is working, he's killing himself working just for what? Verse 4. Just to get more stuff to what? Keep up with other people, impress people he doesn't know, okay? So to speak. The other guy's given up. What's the balance in verse 6? Okay. Yeah, and there is a lot of striving after wind and all of this, okay? And the one who's striving after wind has what, according to this verse? How much does he have? Two hands full, which means he's getting everything he can get, and it's empty. It's striving after wind. What's better than that?
A balance.
A handful of quietness. Instead of just running yourself ragged and killing yourself, trying to run the rat race and win it. Just, you know, a handful means you've been working.
It's enough.
You've worked enough, and you've just been content with that. Quietness means there's peace, there's serenity, there's calmness. You're satisfied with that. So you work the best you can, you take what you've got, and then we've been told this over and over in this book already, just only in the fourth chapter. Enjoy what you have. Little or much, just take your handful and enjoy it. That person in verse 6, at the beginning of verse 6, is so much better off than the person at the end of verse 6 with two hands full. He's better off than the person who's given up and folded his hands, and he's better off than the person who's running the rat race. Wow, this is a lot of wisdom right here. A lot of wisdom. And if there's ever anything to instill in our children and teach our children, and we live in a society where there's such a push, you know, you got to be a success and you got to get this education. And I had teaching colleagues. I never had it personally. I had teaching colleagues who actually had parents tell them, you've ruined my child's life because this 9 weeks they got a B in the ninth grade. They got a B in the ninth grade, one grading period, and they're saying they can't get into the college they want. And I'm not making this up, okay? I'm not making this up. And that is so skewed. One of the greatest things we can do for our children is not so much, you know, and I think a person ought to be taught to strive and be the best they can and develop themselves, and all that's great, okay? But what's most important is learn to be content with what you've got and be at peace with that. Do the best you can, but don't agitate yourself by trying to climb this ladder where the higher you get, the thinner the air is. And you just smother. Can't breathe. And there's just so much wisdom here. And this is coming from a man who what? Think about it. If it's Solomon, certainly we understand that. But according to chapter 2, he's Solomon-like. This is coming from a man who's what? Had all kinds of possessions and accomplishments. This is coming from the guy who had it all. And we'd be wise to listen to him. Okay, 7 and 8. Daryl, can you read that, please?
Then I looked again at vanity under the sun. There was a certain man without a dependent, having neither a son nor a brother, yet there was no end to all his labor. Indeed, his eyes were not satisfied with riches, and he never asked, and for whom am I laboring and depriving myself of pleasure? This too is vanity, and it is a grievous task.
Okay. Look at this person. He's running the rat race. He's working himself to just a nub. But what does he lack? Relationships. What's he doing it for? Who's he doing it for? Self. And he's depicted very sadly, in a sad way here. This is the lonely workaholic. Look how he's focused on his work, okay? There is no end to all his toil. He constantly works. Now, we understand, we've just been reading in Proverbs, studying in Proverbs. Proverbs highly values work. Tons of other scriptures highly value work. But again, it's putting things in perspective. He's living just to toil. Just to work, okay? And the more he gets, what? In verse 8. Rick mentioned that a while ago, sort of, in another context. He's never satisfied. He keeps getting more and more and more, and he's never satisfied. It's never enough, okay? But, and you know, there's a lot of ways to look at this. This is the person who's so focused on his work and trying to prove himself there and accomplish there that he never takes the time to cultivate relationships. Or the person who has some relationships, what happens to him because he lives this way? Destroys him. And we talked about the other day, we couldn't count the number of leaves, you know. It's innumerable the number of people who've done that with their lives, who've destroyed their relationships because they were the lonely workaholic. And certainly a lot of men. But I don't think it's just men. No, it could be women too. Yeah, Dan.
God in creation worked 6 days and he was pleased with what he had. And then he rested. He was satisfied.
There's some insight there. There is insight in that. Yeah, Zachary.
As we were reading this, seeing a progression from verse 5, the fool who folds his hands, he's got. Essentially, at that point, two hands full of quietness in that. He's not doing anything. And then you've got suggestion of one better than one handful of quietness. By implication, you have the other handful of oil. Rather than having two hands full of oil, which 7 and 8 is giving you an example of somebody who has both hands full of oil. He doesn't leave room for anything else.
Yeah, the guy in verse 7 and 8 is similar, if not the same guy in verse 4. Right. I mean, he's consumed with his work, but no peace. Exactly right. And that's why that verse 6 is, the beginning of verse 6 is that balanced person. He's not got him folded. He's not got him overly full. He's got a balance there. Okay, and there, that's the sweet spot, so to speak. That's where the peace is and all that. Okay. And verse 7 and 8 just really depicts a person empty and in a pathetic kind of state. And I want to say this about, I say that about men. It's not just men. It can be women too, regarding jobs, but also sort of the Martha syndrome. And I did a sermon on this. We had a Bible class, right, on Mary and Martha. That's what it was. And we talked a little bit about that. And we're not just talking about occupations. But, you know, whether it's the cleaning or whether it's the, you know, landscaping, gardening, whatever, your work cannot crowd people out. Because really, think about how that is said there in verse 7 and 8. One person who has no other, either son or brother, yet there is no end to all his toil. Work has consumed the person. He's pushed out everybody else, or he's not allowed them in. And any kind of work can do that. Any kind of toil. Rather, the picture should be the work and the toil is for those people. You're working and toiling to facilitate your relationships, provide for family or whatever, or enjoy those things with them, do them with them or whatever. And, you know, that can happen to anybody, any gender, any kind of work, that it's got to be about people, not about just the work. And I would propose to you, too, that even in an occupational setting, the people in a job setting who are focused on people are, in the long run, the happiest in their work and do the best work. People are always most important, not the work. The work serves the people. That's the point. Yeah.
I think sometimes we get our occupation confused with our vocation, that our what we do for a living or how we spend our days defines us, but it's our calling by God that really should define us and create our focus even in our workplace.
Right. And that helps to develop the right expectations of our work, puts it in perspective. This is a lot of wisdom here, okay? In verse 8 here, he finally asks the question. What does he finally, it dawns on him, and he asks what question?
Why?
Why am I doing this? And specifically, why am I toiling, and what? What does he say? Depriving myself of what?
Pleasure.
Okay. What do we mean by this? So he's working all the time and he's not partying? Does he never take a vacation? Does he never have fun? No. That's not what I think it is. In Ecclesiastes, what is the pleasure? Well, look back in verse 6. And look back in chapter 3, verse 12 and 13. Chapter 4, verse 6, and chapter 3, verse 12 and 13. In the context of Ecclesiastes, what's pleasure? Because he's depicting pleasure as a good thing. What's pleasure?
Enjoying the fruit of your labor.
Having balance, being content with what you've got, enjoying what you've got. He's depriving himself of that joy because he's trying to accomplish more and more. He's never satisfied. He doesn't even have anybody to share it with. He's got a giant mansion and nobody in it with him. He's got carved with all kinds of seats and nobody in them. And there's different ways that happens. I would dare say that there are a lot of rich, powerful people who would trade all that fame and money at some point in their life just to have that spouse back or a good relationship with their kids. And they don't. Somebody asked me one time, I forgot who it was, you know. Oh, yeah, I remember who it was. You know, which president was a really good family man. Took me a long time to come up with one. I can think of a couple. Most of them aren't. Going all the way back. See how it goes hand in hand? You know, there are some choices. You know, are you going to have both hands full? Everything you want? Or are you going to let some things go to capture what is really meaningful? You know, yes?
There was a lyric of a song years ago. I can't remember the name of the song. Who did it? Part of the lines was, "When you're coming home, Dad, I don't know when."
Cast the Crow.
Yeah, Cast the Crow.
Yeah, Harry Chapin.
Thank you. I tell you, this is the kind of crowd you can't think of. Somebody in this crowd will come up with the artist and the song. Okay, this is a music advanced crowd right here. So that's a really good song with this chapter. Really is. I remember when I was young and heard that. That made me cry. Let alone now. So let's move on. I don't want to cry about that. That's very sad. All right, verse 9 to 12. Let's read these. Elaine, can you read those verses, please?
Return for their labor. For if either of them falls, the one will lift up his companion, but woe to the one who falls when there is not another to lift him up. Furthermore, if two lie down together, they keep warm, but how can one be warm alone? And if one can overpower him who is alone, two can resist him. A cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart.
All right, thank you. So look at the contrast. You see the flow of thought here. He's just talked about someone who has all these possessions and success in their toil, but they don't have what? Verse 7 and 8. Relationships. Anybody to share it with? Here, he builds on that and he says, two are better than one. It's good to have companionship. Now, I don't think this is limited to marriage. He doesn't limit it to marriage. Definitely includes marriage, no doubt about it. But it really is talking about any kind of relationship with a companion, a coworker, a friend, a good neighbor, a family member. It's anybody that you're going through life with, okay? And what are the benefits? What does it say? Okay, fall down, get helped up. And the other expression is, if you're what? If you're cold, you can get warm, okay? Understand that in times before ours, this is different. It was not uncommon for people to sleep in a bed together that were like friends or something for that reason. Because not everybody had central heat, okay? So that's just a real practical kind of thing. It's like, you know, huddled together around a fire, that kind of thing. And this is not just talking about stumbling onto the road or being cold in the middle of the night. These are expressions. I mean that when you have needs or you have problems or you need help, somebody's there to help you. And I've struggled with the end of verse 12, a threefold cord is not quickly broken. I think the most logical explanation is, you know, having a companion's great. Having even a second companion's even better. Three people, okay? Threefold cord, it just adds strength. The more, the better. A strength in numbers, that kind of thing. Some people say that this is God, that you, somebody else in God, like in marriage. Yeah, that's good. I don't know if that verse just exclusively teaches that because God's not mentioned. But it's the idea that there's strength in numbers. I mean, it's really the idea. Why is this here? Why is this an important principle in light of the big picture of this book?
Teaching us that relationships are more important than anything else.
He's been talking about the things that don't matter in the long run. Here he's talking about something that does matter. Relationships.
Relationships are the only thing we can take with us into eternity.
It's true. People can love us back. Big houses can't. Garage full of cars can't love us back. Just can't do that. Think about it. So far, he's depicted life as what? Yeah, I know vain, but what else? What's it like to live life on earth?
Grievous.
It's hard. It's grievous. It's difficult. It's burdensome. So it's good to know we're in this together. This is a hard life to get through. It's good to have help along the way. It's good to have partners along the way to deal with it. There are a lot of different ways that we have to deal with our problems. And sometimes we do need a long time. Just like Jesus went up on the mountain to pray sometimes all night long by himself. There are times that Jesus pulled apart from people. And there are times we have to do that. But generally, we can handle life's problems better by including other people. He's always got a partner. Look at Romans 16, all those people he talks about. And then you got Titus, and you got Timothy, and you got Barnabas, and you got Silas. It's just one after the other. Yeah. There you go. You're going to say that? Okay. I mean, that's very much a principle in the New Testament, isn't there?
The principle of the church, really.
And it's the principle of the church, one another. That's exactly right. So real quickly here, look at verse 13 to 16. Gary, can you read those last 13 to 16?
Better was a poor and wise youth than a bold and foolish king who no longer knew how to take advice. For he went from prison to the throne, though in his own kingdom he had been born poor. I saw all the living who had moved about under the sun, along with that youth who was to stand in the king's place. There was no end of all the people, all of whom he led. Yet those who came later will not rejoice in him. Surely this is also his vanity and his striving after him.
Thank you. Two kings talk about here. One king is old and in the way. He's a king, but he doesn't listen anymore. He's too long in the saddle, as they say. Out of touch. And along comes another king. Actually, his background is what?
Prison.
I'm sorry, what?
Prison.
Okay. Yes, or been poor, depending on the translation there. In other words, his background... Oh, yeah, in prison. He went from prison to the throne. Sorry, yeah. Okay, sorry. He's been in prison, and he's also been poor. In other words, he's the most unlikely candidate, but he becomes king. And matter of fact, what kind of following does he get? Verse 16. Huge, huge following. Doesn't everybody love that story? The nobody becomes king? Look how many fairy tales. There's Cinderella, you know, because she becomes the princess, but you know what I mean. Everybody loves that motif. The nobody becomes the somebody. Everybody loves that. But even in this story, which is one of the best, you know, kind of outcomes, according to verse 16, eventually, this young king who becomes so wonderful and followed, eventually what? Those who come later will not, what?
Yeah.
Not rejoice in him. In other words, we're done with him. Okay? It's the loneliness of the pinnacle. There's no saying, you heard every time a new person's elected president, they'll say to the president, if you don't have a dog, you need to get one when you go to Washington, D.C., because that's the only friend you're going to have. You ever heard that? Okay? Stranded on that pinnacle. Even a king goes through the same cycles we've been looking at. Okay? It doesn't turn out the way you would dream it would be. It's just not what it's cracked up to be. All right. Okay. Hang in there. Don't let it get you too down. There's good in this. Take it all in. Thank you very much.